Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio, brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889, and by WTIC. You'll meet Senator Claghorn's best friend, Kenny Delmar, after these words from the Burritt.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the money place. You've heard about the new higher rates on savings accounts. Maybe you've seen ads that mention 7% or more interest on savings certificates. Well, a savings certificate is a special account. 2.5 years is the minimum term on the new 6.75% certificates. At the Big B, Burritt Mutual, they work like this. Deposit $1,000 in one of these certificates and leave it on deposit, and you'll earn even more than 6.75%. That's because Burritt pays you interest continuously, and the interest earns interest too. So the actual yield at maturity comes to 7.08% at the Big B. That's the straight story, the facts. That's what you'll get at any office of the Big B in New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Member FDIC.
And now your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and welcome once again to the Golden Age of Radio. This is Dick Bertel, and with me is the man who makes this program possible because of his extensive collection of old-time radio memories. I'm talking, of course, about Ed Corcoran. And Ed, we have a special guest tonight, don't we?
Yes, Dick. We have a distinguished senator from Washington who is in Hartford for this particular occasion. Dick.
Yes, Senator, I wonder if you would give us your...
Yeah, I say you. Now, listen, don't interrupt, son. Claghorn's the name. Senator Claghorn, that is. Start laughing. Yeah. We might as well. We're stuck with each other. I'm from the South. I'm from so far south, some of my neighbors are still waiting for Grant to surrender. Who knows how it might have turned out. Yeah. Pay attention now. I got to be out of here by Sunday.
Senator Claghorn,
yeah,
of course.
Speak up, boy. I don't hear so good from this ear.
At any rate,
yes, sir.
Kenny Delmar is our guest tonight, who created Senator Claghorn on the Fred Allen program, and who actually had a much more extensive role in radio, as you can attest to, Ed, because of your research.
Yes, in fact, this is just a very small part. We'll find out tonight that he did so many things you just wouldn't believe. The dramatic roles, announcing, and other comedy besides Claghorn.
So. Well, Claghorn, if I can interrupt for a minute, was the only character that I created that was imitated so much.
You told us something else, too, Kenny, that Senator Claghorn was very, very believable, very real. His convictions were very real to you, and the character developed accordingly.
I think that's why he, there have been so many Southern accents and so many brilliant comedians and actors and characters playing Southerners, but I think the reason why Senator Claghorn was accepted and loved in the South, and when I say loved, I was sent Confederate violets by these little bells in Alabama and in Georgia and various other parts of the South. I was sent, one chap with a brilliant sense of humor sent me a 15-foot slingshot that came through the mail, and on it was a tag saying, "That's a yoke, son." He was accepted because he was sincere.
Yes, I suppose
that's
right.
He loved in the North, too.
Yes.
Kenny,
yes, the North, where I was born, in Boston. This is always a big shock when they find that Senator Claghorn was born in Boston.
The senator had his start really not with Fred Allen at all, but with Alan Young.
Well, that character.
Yeah.
Yes, he was called Counselor Carton Branch, And I had told some ridiculous witticism. Oh, my goodness. I did some little gag, you know. And the audience laughed. And I don't know what Alan Young was thinking about, but he just had a blank expression. And I leaned over and said, "That's a joke, son," which got another laugh from the audience. And it remained my tag, my catchphrase after that.
I think people remember that line better than any other on the Fred Allen Show. That's a joke, son.
Yeah, they made a movie of it, and they paid me in Confederate money.
Kenny Delmar makes his home in Stamford, Connecticut for the better part of the year, and then during the winter months, you vacation and winter in Florida.
Yeah, I'm down there. They named the swamp after me.
Did they? Really?
Well, I love it down in West Palm Beach. It's really
beautiful. Oh, it must be beautiful.
I'm just sorry they're building so many condominiums, because West Palm Beach was a delightful village. So I'd like to say now, the weather is lousy in Florida. Please don't come down there.
You know, Kenny, most people, I think, in this business who have followed this business have an idea that you were an announcer who suddenly discovered he had a bent for comedy and began to develop that facet of his talent.
No, that isn't...
That isn't the way it was.
No, I really acted the part of an announcer. I am not an announcer, really. The announcers that I liked, I tried to copy, and I thought maybe in that way I'd be better known, and that's what happened. It was really a very good idea to do that.
Let's start at the beginning. Let's go back to Boston and those early days in vaudeville.
Oh, yes. Well, my mother managed me. My mother was one of the Delmar sisters, and the whole family. I think probably it was by osmosis that I learned how to do dialects. My mother was a dialectician, and when she put me in vaudeville, we did different acts. One of them was called the Seven Rosebuds. I shouldn't say anything that vulgar on the air, but there we were on our tippy toes. We played all over America.
And it must have been great training ground for any form of show business.
It was indeed. Hmm. I don't know what the kids can do today, and I think they're wonderful. I think that they are as dedicated as we were, with the exception that we had a little more rules to live by than they do today. And I'm rather sorry that we did have those rules, because it seems to me that the kids today have so much more with the lack of restriction. I think that it's more creative being free, and so the kids have the advantage over us in that respect. So many of my friends that are in my age group, that is over 40.
Don't move the bed, nurse. My goodness, I fell in love with that woman across the way, but she keeps stealing my oxygen tent.
Anyway, guys around my age, they seem to resent the young kids, you know, and I don't. So I hope that answers your question.
I guess it does.
Why'd you ask me? I didn't know. Please, turn off. Turn off the noise. How can you have all these birds flying around in a small studio? For goodness sakes, I never heard of such. Go ahead.
Let's turn to WHN. That's
I wasn't even there. I didn't have the gun. It must have been somebody else. I heard it crashing. I looked around. There was a dead body with glass all over the place. How can you blame me? I wasn't even in the apartment. But it's here.
So, WHN. That's where you had your radio training, I guess, before the networks.
Yeah. WHN. It belonged to Lowe's. And we kids were trying to learn about radio. And we found out that they needed us because they kept using us on different programs. And they'd say, "Hey, Kenny, are you busy? Come on, we want to do this show. You play the conductor." And you'd go on the air without even having a chance to study the script. So we had a meeting. There were about six of us together, and we had no money. We said, "Why don't we go to these people and say we want $20 a week?" And that's what we got. We were paid $20 a week, and it was the WHN Stock Company, and that was the beginning of what today is AFTRA.
But, of course, this training ground led to the first network shot.
Yeah, what was your first network effort, Kenny? Do you recall?
Oh, yes. That was for Irving Reese. It was a very interesting program, a half-hour show called The Executioner. And Irving Reese kept me on after that show, and I never had to go back to WHN.
Don't send me back. Don't send me back to WHN.
Oh, actually, I went on to CBS, Columbia Workshop. And naturally, when you worked for Irving Reese, all the other directors had respect for you. And so that was the beginning of a career that lasted until just a few years ago, because there's no more radio dramatic shows now, you know, to do, really.
Our guest tonight, Kenny Delmar, here on the Golden Age of Radio. Kenny Delmar, who for so many years entertained us as Senator Claghorn, but was heard on countless radio shows, perhaps the most famous or infamous of which was War of the Worlds, Ed.
Oh, yes. I was really surprised when I found out that Kenny was on this show because there were so many famous people. You mind if I just read a few of them here, Kenny?
Yeah.
Everett Sloan, Ray Collins, Agnes Moorehead, Martin Gable, George Koulouris, Joseph Cotten, Paul Stewart, and Dan Seymour, all were part of this great theatrical troupe. Could you tell us how you got into this and about the War of the Worlds show itself, Kenny, how it got started and everything?
Well, actually, one of the important things about that, you mentioned Paul Stewart. Paul Stewart directed us in the show. And Orson, who had 5,000 things on his mind every day, and who was then doing the Mercury Theater, came in the last 2 hours of the program after Paul had directed it. And Orson made a few changes, one of them being, I said, I can't do Orson, they won't let me do Roosevelt. And Orson said, oh, come on, Kenny, you know what to do with the thing, you know. So I went on and I didn't do Roosevelt. But one out of every 5 words suggested that he might have been a good friend of FDR.
Yeah, the Secretary of the Interior.
That's what he was called.
Would you like to hear that exact excerpt? From that? This was back in 1938, Dick, wasn't
That's
it?
That's right,
this show
October
was on.
30th.
And this was one of three roles you played on that show.
That's right.
Well, let's listen to that for just a minute and hear those very Rooseveltian tones. Is that the way to express it?
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military forces to keep them there. In the meantime, placing our faith in God, we must continue the performance of our duties, each and every one of us, so that we may confront this destructive adversary with a nation united, courageous, and consecrated to the preservation of human supremacy on this earth. I thank you.
All right, let's get back now to the origin of this program. It was just one of a series on the Mercury Theater, wasn't it, Kenny?
Yes.
Did anybody anticipate that
what did happen, actually? No, we just thought it was a very interesting show. We did know that it was a very well done show. One of the things Ray Collins did in his scene was to make this announcement, stop toward the end of it, cough a little bit, and then hold onto the microphone and slide down the microphone onto the floor.
I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building. I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. Estimated in the last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchison River Parkway is still kept open for motor traffic. Avoid bridges to Long Island, hopelessly jammed. All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army is wiped out. Artillery, Air Force, everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end. People are holding service here below us in the cathedral. Now I look down the harbor, all manner of boats, overloaded with fleeing population, pulling out from docks. Streets are all jammed. Noise and crowds like New Year's Eve in city. Wait a minute. The enemy is now in sight above the Palisades. Five great machines. First one is crossing the river. I can see it from here, wading the Hudson like a man wading through a brook. A bulletin is handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country. One outside of Buffalo, one in Chicago, St. Louis. Seem to be timed and spaced. Now the first machine reaches the shore. He stands watching, looking over the city. Steel cowlish head is even with the skyscrapers. He waits for the others. They rise like a line of new towers on the city's west side. Now they're lifting their metal hands. This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's 50 feet.
And that's the way it was done on the air.
What happened after the show was over?
Well, before the show was over, the first act, by that time, all of the we were answering the telephones. It was in CBS at 485 Madison Avenue up on the top studio there. And we actors, Carl Frank, who came in the second act and played a part of a pilot, was answering. We were answering the phones.
Mm-hmm.
And the people swore at us and screamed and hysterical. This is before the second act went on. It was unbelievable, the effect. And then, of course, you know, after that, it was history. Orson was had a press conference, and when he was told that people had been killed and on the Pulaski Skyway, the cars were all going 70 and 80 miles an hour trying to avoid these monsters that, you know, mm-hmm. weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it made a law that you cannot, you know, the American public can never be fooled like that again.
Yeah. That is, unless they're in politics.
Then they can be fooled.
Fair game after that.
Well, at any rate, there was nothing malicious about this originally.
No. Orson simply, in his genius, knew this was a Halloween prank, and boy, mm-hmm. it sure was.
I want to turn to that part of your career which I remember so well, that of Kenny Delmar, the announcer. And you said earlier in the program that you always act the part of an announcer that you didn't really feel you were.
No.
Yet you sold an awful lot of product very effectively, and one of the biggest shows that you did was the program that we open up with as part of our montage in this program every month, Ed, the Lucky Strike Hit Parade.
Yes, well, that kind of announcing I really didn't believe in, but because Mr. Hill was paying me at that time.
And Mr. Hill was... How much? What?
George Washington Hill was paying me 750 with a couple of O's behind.
That's a nice lot of O's.
Guess that's a lot of O's.
My gracious.
And some of it I saved later on for Liverpool, you see. But I never been to China.
However, the thing is that I knew what he wanted, and I was told what he wanted, and I was...
He was the head of American Tobacco Company,
yes,
right.
Yes, that's right. I was doing the Hit Parade with Frank Sinatra. A very wonderful guy, by the way. And I used to kid him. I was the first one to kid him being so thin. One of the things was I said to the girls out in the audience, I said, now you girls all are interested in Frank. I want to tell you that when he was born, he weighed 8 pounds. Of course, he's lost some weight since. I mean, this is the way I kidded about Frankie. All right, that was at the Playhouse on 54th Street. Then I did The Best Tunes of All, moved to Carnegie Hall. And then I did Lucky Strike Green Has Gone to War with the K. Kaiser's College of Musical Knowledge, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Three distinct different programs for Lucky Strike. And boy, that was a lot of strident and dramatic and offensive to me announcing.
Well, of course, it was a big voice that you used, and yet it seemed to fit. Obviously, Mr. Hill was happy with it.
Yes, and he personally had to be happy with anything that was connected. For Mark Warnow on the hit parade, he and his secretary danced to the various tunes, and if they couldn't dance, it just didn't go on the program.
Really?
So that gives you a rough idea.
Well, Kenny, turning from your connection with your hit parade, you mentioned earlier the Theatre Guild of the Air, and Ed has come up with an excerpt from that show. And this is a fine example, I think, of a major radio production with major actors, a full orchestra, and so on. The particular excerpt we're going to hear is from the show The Farmer Takes a Wife.
The Theatre Guild on the air. Our stars, William Holden, Claire Trevor, and Kenny Delmar. Our play, The Farmer Takes a Wife, by Frank Elser and Mark Connolly. Based on the novel Rome Hall by Walter Edmonds. Produced on the air tonight by the Theatre Guild, one of America's foremost theatrical producers. And here is Roger Pryor speaking for the Theatre Guild.
Good evening, everyone. Our play tonight is a comedy concerned with the colorful fraternity of boaters on the Erie Canal in the days when the boats plied the big ditch from Albany to Buffalo. Life on the canal in the 50s was exciting and glamorous, rough and ready. Romance was to be found at every lock, adventure round every bend. Starred as Molly, cook on the Sarcy Sal, is Broadway and Hollywood's Claire Trevor. As Dan, William Holden, out of service and back in the motion pictures. And as Fortune, Kenny Delmar, the Senator Claghorn of Fred Allen's Alley. June Walker is featured as Lucy, and Hope Emerson as Gammy. Let's raise the curtain now on Act One of The Farmer Takes a Wife. The year is 1853. This is the era of President Franklin Pierce, tall felt hats for the men and voluminous skirts for the ladies. The city of Rome, New York, between Utica and Albany on the Erie Canal, shows signs of becoming a thriving metropolis. Horses and carriages dash madly up the streets, and they've even put up a hotel. Uh-oh, hear that? That's the new railroad they're building. Folks who make it their living on the canal don't like the idea of it, not one bit. But you'll hear more about that later.
So your name is Dan Harrow, and you're looking for Sam Weaver. Is that it?
Yes, Mrs. Hennessy.
Well, he ain't here. And don't call me Mrs. Hennessy. I ain't used to it. Gammy's the name.
Yes, ma'am.
Why don't you have yourself a snort in the bar inside? Sooner or later, Sam will come in for one himself.
Oh, well, I ain't much of a drinking man, ma'am. Can I just sit in there?
Sure. And if you got nothing else to do, you can give Fortune Friendly a hand. He's got his dentist chair set up next to the bar. Maybe you can hold down the patient.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I'll just go in and watch.
Don't let him entice you into that chair if you know what's good for you.
Hi, Gammy.
Well, if it ain't Lucy and Saul.
Well, Gammy, looks like you're going to do a land office business here this year.
Mighty pretty sight. All you boaters back again, Lucy.
Gammy, I ain't never seen such a crowd the day before the canal opens. Just look at them in there, milling around that bar.
Well, I must say, Lucy, you and Saul are looking plumb full of get up and go. When are you two going to get yourselves married?
Us?
Who else would I mean? You've been canaling together long enough.
Gammy, ever since Jonas died, I've been sole owner and cook of the Evening Star. And Saul here's been my boater. Us two's been engaged for 19 years, and that's the way it's going to stay.
Well, Saul, there's lots worse things than being an engaged man.
Well, it's novel at that. Carries interest and privileges and no responsibilities. That's the way I like it.
Oh! Hey, what's Fortune Friendly doing to that fella in the chair?
Murdering him?
Didn't you know, Lucy? Fortune's a dentist now.
I thought he was a preacher and a gambler.
Oh, he's anything that don't look like work. It comes from having a college education.
How'd he come to change to be a teeth duck?
Well, he won some tools in a dice game off a dentist in Albany. Then he got himself one of them how-to-do-it books and set up shop with that old barber chair alongside the bar.
What's he charge for pulling a tooth?
2 bits apiece.
Ain't that rather high?
Well, he says he don't pull teeth. He extracts them. That makes him a specialist.
Oh!
Hey, Fortune, ain't you through torturing that poor devil yet?
What's that? Excuse me, Mr. Simpkins. Just keep your mouth open till I get back. Madam Hennessy, from now on, kindly address me as doctor, if you please.
Doctor, you don't have no more diploma than a jackrabbit.
Ah, that's where you're wrong, dear lady. I am the proud recipient of such a testimonial from the Intercontinental Conservatory of Internal and Oral Surgery.
What kind of a school is that?
Oh, just a little thing I run on the side. How are you, Saul?
Oh, fine, fine. Last time I seen you, Fortune, you had a banjo torch and was hawking snake oil on street corners.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember it well, but not snake oil, my friend. Oh, no. I was introducing Lone Star Miracle Emulsion to the public. A public service. My own preparation, by the way, made from nature's ingredients. From a secret formula obtained from the red man. Nothing better for rheumatism, ringworm, housemaid's knee, canker sores, or chronic flatulence. It also restores the natural color and gloss to the hair. Remind me to present you good people with a sample. I have a large bottle.
You're all right. Lively preacher, Fortune. Why'd you give it up?
Well, to tell the truth, I had to. The trouble is, people won't hire you to give just one sermon. They want you to stay in town and give them 5 or 6. Now, I got 1 or 2 dissertations of an ecclesiastical nature that are whizzes. But when I got to do 5 or 6, I just plain run out of material and start repeating myself. People don't like that. They want a new show every night.
Hey, Fortune, ain't you gonna finish me up?
Oh, my patient, excuse me. Coming, brother, coming.
A sampling of The Farmer Takes a Wife from Theater Guild of the Air. And we'll be back right after this message.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the money place. Confused by all the ads about new higher interest rates on savings accounts? Many people are. Some banks are advertising 5% as a top rate. Some are even advertising rates over 7% on special types of accounts. Well, these are the facts. Federal regulations control the amounts that financial institutions can pay you. And only thrift institutions like Burritt Mutual Savings Bank can pay you the maximum amounts controlled by law. For example, 5.25% is the new legal rate allowed on regular accounts at savings banks. That's the top rate allowed. No one can pay you more. Some banks can't pay you as much. To get all the facts, get to the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, in New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Burritt Mutual Savings, the money place. Member FDIC.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and the recordings of Ed Corcoran. Brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889, and by WTIC. This is Dick Bertel.
And this is Ed Corcoran.
And our guest tonight is Kenny Delmar here on the Golden Age of Radio. And we're really having some great times reliving that wonderful era of Kenny Delmar, the announcer for the Hit Parade and for Jack Benny. Now, Don Wilson was Jack's announcer, yet you were doing the commercials, were you?
Well, no, every time. I was doing the commercials, but you see, whenever Jack came to New York, I took over the program while he was in New York.
Oh, I get it.
You know, being that it was Lucky Strike, it was like the Lucky Strike family.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, aside from that was the great feud between Jack Benny and Fred Allen, which was a marvelous, really wonderful thing. And a lot of people were serious about it. They thought that there was a feud, actually, but it wasn't. Jack Benny and Fred Allen were very good friends.
You talked about Fred Allen as a genius. I guess everyone will agree to that. And yet he never interfered with anybody in the cast.
We never received one line of direction from Fred Allen. And the marvelous thing about it was that Fred Allen had just as much respect for his company as they had for him. Now, doesn't that seem like the proper way for it to be? If he hired a director of music, as he did, on many shows, Peter Van Steeden and various other conductors. He never made any suggestions about the music. If he hired me to do Senator Claghorn, he never assumed that he would be able to do the character better than I did, because he hired me to do it. The same with Peter Donald, Parker Fenley.
How did the character actually get started? Was the idea formulated and you did it, or just how did it come about? Do you remember exactly?
You mean Claghorn?
Claghorn himself.
Well, no, Claghorn himself, without the catchphrase of "It's a joke, son," with Alan Young, started when I was hitchhiking to California, and I met a Texan that picked me up in a car, and this car made a lot of noise, but that didn't bother him any.
He talked over the car, son. I raise hogs, razorbacks.
Now, he looked at me, and if I didn't respond, he'd go all over it again. So I added the joke to say, "That's a joke, son," because this man was determined that I wouldn't miss one word. I say, "One word, boy. If you're listening, you should be laughing." I called him Dynamite Gus, because we were all through the oil fields there, and these guys with the dynamite were marvelous characters. They all spoke loudly. I don't know why. Maybe the gush is coming in or something.
Shooting in the afternoon, and I don't mean pool.
Anyway, you know, they were really robust. Now, when Fred heard the character was called Counselor Cartenbranch on the Alan Young show, when he heard that, he made him senator, and he gave him the name. And of course, Fred was just loved names.
Sure, sure.
I once got a part that I auditioned for through a name, and it was Carl Sandburg. I played Carl Sandburg for the Theater Guild. And the name was Senania, and that's the way I said it. And Carl Sandburg said, "I'll take that one." All the actors had auditioned. And just that name, that was the name of his horse, Senania. But Fred would make up names, and some of the names that he made up were, you know, just marvelous.
Sure.
Like W.C. Claghorn, Fields, too, was the same way.
Yeah, Fields.
Falstaff,
yeah.
Openshore.
Openshore, yeah. Was sure, the poet. Beautiful. That was Alan. Yeah. That was Ted.
You discuss a topic each week, so supposedly something current in the news, the raising of the subway fare in New York or something.
They're going to do it again, too, Dick.
Well, it's only you people up north here that spend 50 cents to go down in a tunnel.
The senator's home.
I'll knock and see what happens.
Somebody, I say, somebody knock.
Yes, I know.
Claghorn's the name, Senator Claghorn, that is.
I know you're from the South.
When I'm in New York, I'll never go to the Yankee Stadium.
Now, wait a minute.
Go to see the Giants unless a southpaw's pitching.
Well, look,
I refuse to watch the Dodgers unless Dixie Walker's playing.
Now, wait a minute.
Stop interrupting. Where's your manners?
Manners? I have more.
Try listening. You might learn something.
Listen, all I'll ever learn.
Your tongue's wagging like a blind dog's tail in a meat market.
You're winded, hey?
Just sucking in some air, son.
Well, leave a little. I'm breathing, too, you know. Tell me, Senator, what is Washington doing about coal prevention?
The Senate reconvened just in time.
Yeah? Uh-huh.
I was glad to see Senator Aiken back. Aiken back. That's a joke, son.
I know it's a joke. I know.
That was a scrawny side splitter.
I wouldn't guess.
That was a squeeze port shrieker.
Listen, you don't know what it is.
I keep tossing them and you just sidestep them.
Well, look at me. Now, wait.
Say, you're a regular sad sack. Sack, that is.
Now, you wait. Tell me, cool off now just a second. Do you have a favorite cure for a cold?
I caught a cold last week.
Yeah?
Like to ruin my filibuster.
Ruin your filibuster? What did you do?
I took an old southern remedy, son. I drank down 2 buckets of hot mint julep.
You drank 2 buckets of hot mint juleps and you still held the floor?
Held the floor? Son, I couldn't get up off it.
How long did you do Senator Claghorn?
Well,
on that show.
Oh, just 3 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all? It seemed like you did it forever.
Yeah, isn't it funny?
I know, but you see, it happened the first week. America fell in love with him. I don't know. It just struck home right away. They just loved him. And, of course, telling Fred Allen what was humor. All America knew that Fred Allen was really a great comedian
sure.
and a humorist. Not like Dynamite Gus, if you will.
telling, that's a joke, son. I tried to look over at this guy and say,
would there be a lot
that's
of...
a matter of opinion, Kenny.
So, Chris, you also had another incident with a pie, a lemon meringue pie, was
that
it?
That was the feud, one of the high spots of the feud. Max Asnas from the stage sent over a lemon meringue pie, and it was ridiculously high. It was about 4 inches high. And at one point, Fred says to Benny, Benny's supposed to get the pie in the face, you see, and I'm holding it right on the mic. And Fred says, show him the pie, Kenny. And as I lifted it, the lemon meringue went floating off into the audience. They screamed and hollered, and Fred got angry with me, thinking I had deliberately, but I swear to you, I did not. It was so light, that meringue, that it just flew over like a bird. Well, it never got thrown at Benny anyway. And after he looked at the lemon meringue, he says to Fred, couldn't you make it something like blueberries?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kenny, you said that you worked very often, perhaps exclusively, for the ad agencies, that you didn't work for the networks.
No, the ad agencies in those days really were the producers and the creators of these programs. And there was the rivalry that existed between the agencies really represented the shows that they had on the air that were top shows. After all, what better way could you sell something on the air than to say, we have the biggest audience? And in those days, it was three big ones. It was BBDNO, Young and Rubicam, and J. Walter Thompson. And these agencies all had their own creative directors that did these programs. And the American public demanded that the programs be good. It did not prove the 12-year-old audience, which people like to say. It proved that when we did beautiful classics, when we did very fine shows, the audience proved it by buying the product. And of course, at the same time, there were sensational shows that did well, like The Shadow, which of course was a relaxing thing. Some of our great minds like to read the comics for relaxation, and this may also have been true about radio. I don't know
what
to say.
I'm sure it was, yeah. Kenny, I want to talk to you about dialects. Now, all through the program, you've been sprinkling your conversation with marvelous dialects, and there were very few in the business who could really do effective dialects, a number of them. Am I right?
Well, the group on the March of Time, we all did dialects. Mm-hmm. Ted DeCorsia just passed away, a very wonderful man. Dwight Weiss, Bill Adams, George Kalouris, Frank Reddick, Paul Stewart, we all did dialects. My mother was a dialectician, and my grandfather was an interpreter. He spoke 13 languages, and I think it was sort of a very natural thing for me to do dialects. Some of them I have since studied. By studied, I mean I've practiced some of them.
There was one accent that you developed a laugh, and then you built a character around it. Could you tell us about that?
That was Sue Chan, and I'm very proud of that program. You see, there's always a key for dialects, for me anyway, because I don't think about the words. I think about the character, and the words come naturally. When I'm doing a Russian, the first thing I think of, if I'm going to play a Russian, is Kadzilak. Now, that's not a commercial.
What is it?
Kadzilak is an automobile. Oh. For drive the car. I played Mr. Sikorsky. I played him on the air for DuPont, I believe it was. And afterwards he said, very good actor. Kenny, good. Only you make one mistake. I have no accent. So, you know, I mean, this is, God help me, that's the truth. So,
and he wasn't kidding.
But in thinking about Sikorsky, I didn't do Sikorsky, I did Kadzilak. Now, Cadillac is so different than Kadzilak. He throws you right into the character. Mm-hmm. And, of course, sometimes we didn't have a lot of time to think about it, you see. But with Chan, he had a very individualistic laugh, which went like this. Yeah, more better. Oh, yeah. So when two character come from not from a word, but from getting feeling to translate, and getting the laugh got me the character. Yeah.
Fred Allen took part in that show, didn't he?
He came in at the end and said, "Kenny, it was very good, except you had too much accent." But I don't think we're going to have accent characterization. That eventually we'll all merge into one patois of sorts, you know, as we will, I think, all of the races. It's no more a Tower of Babel. I think we're all going to be part Chinese and part Russian and part human.
Well, you did a character in Spanish later that was done, like Bill Daner. Didn't he do a song?
Yes, Bill Daner did a character very much like one that I liked and that I did with Del Sharbert many, many years before. Actually, I felt that they were being kicked around a great deal and that nobody understood them and that they should have a sympathetic guy and nobody would put him on.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you can't do that. It's ethnic, you know. But the character, the reason that here's the thing that I was trying to emphasize in that character was that, like in Christmas time, you say that Santa Claus, Joe, Joe, Joe. Well, you know, people say that's very funny, but that's the truth. If you are going to do something, you have to give a great deal of, how do you say that? It's not something that you can come by naturally unless you feel it inside. Emotionally, that's the whole thing, you know? Well,
fantastic.
This character, of course, was something that I had a great deal of sympathy for Pedro. And Bill Dana came along and gave him even more stability and more, you know, and he certainly got a lot more comedy out of it than I do, because I don't tell jokes as Pedro.
It was a character.
Pedro.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course, today he doesn't do the character anymore.
Yeah, he
anymore.
Gave it up. Too much sensitivity in
ethnic areas. That's and right. I think that's perhaps where the ethnic dialect is gone. We can't
that's
use
right.
it today.
That's right. Well, you'd be surprised how many letters Peter Donald got as Ajax Cassidy.
Mm.
And, of course, Fred paid no attention to them because Fred paid no attention to the networks either. But you saw what they you saw what they did to him. They made him a vice president of NBC.
Speaking of Irish accents, reminds me of the time you had the opportunity to do a radio program with the Abbey Players.
Oh, yes. I was very honored about that, too. I played, I think it was called Big Brother. And the thing about that I remember most of all is that there was an Irish boy that was doing a character, a little high voice sort of thing that he was saying. And it was going along like this, answered the thing. And this woman that was working with him stopped in the middle and she says, "What the hell are you doing?" And of course, the director, Homer Fickett, had to fire this guy because she wouldn't work with him. I never now in my life heard such a thing. And of course, her voice was high, but she thought that was all right.
Sure.
But what was he doing it for? You know, it was sort of a road company Barry Fitzgerald.
Well, of course, another show that I remember very much, and which you were, again, a comedian as well as the announcer, was on the Eddie Cantor Show. And Eddie was certainly one of the all-time greats. And could you tell us a little about working with him as opposed, say, to Fred Allen and so forth?
Oh, well, Eddie Cantor was always afraid of being disliked. And it's very sad because a lot of people did dislike him.
And I think it was genuine.
It was unanimous. No, actually, what it amounted to is Eddie Cantor worked very hard. He was a very hard working guy, and people around him were not. They were not, that necessity for stressing everything. There's an English actor that I consider just superb who throws everything away. Well, Mr. Cantor couldn't throw anything away, and actually I liked him very much, and I enjoyed working with him.
Bristol Myers, makers of Ipana for the smile of beauty, and Truche, the beforehand lotion, present the Eddie Cantor Show.
Josephine and Joe were so in love, oh so in love, so much in love. In the hall for hours they would stay. When Josephine came in she'd hear her mother say, "Josephine, please no lean on the bell. When you neck, please no break at the bell." I heard Mrs. Caruso telling Mrs. O'Flynn, "Somebody keeps ringing, but nobody comes in. You can squeeze all you please, that's all right. But don't keep us from sleep every night. When you kiss in the hall, stay away from the wall. Josephine, please no lean on the bell. When you come up from work and you wanted the supper, I'm a cook of the nice macaron. Then you make her sit down, then you make her get up for your fella, he call on the phone. You go to the park and you sit in the dock and you make her what they call it, a pet. It's lipstick here and a lipstick there, you know, get it from eating spaghetti. You say a good night about 11 o'clock, it's what a good gal should do.
but you take it too long. When you say the good night, you no finish till 2:30. Say, why you no bringing your fella upstairs, ravioli with peppers I cook? You can make it the love with a kiss and the hug and the mom and the pop, then a look. Then I bring you up and I make you fat with a soup and a pasta fazool. Now you stay up late and I make you tin. What's the matter? You making me fool? Why you know I get married and raise the fam, then I make you promise I keep. I'll buy you the furniture and pay for your rent, then we all can get us some sleep. Josephine, please don't lean on the bell. When you neck, please no breaking the bell. I heard Mrs. Galino say she called the police. The landlord, he say he's gonna break in the lease. All is still just as still as a little mouse. Till your charm spread alarms through the house. Won't that guy ever leave? Every night's New Year's Eve. Josephine, please don't lean on the bell.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And Kenny Delmar, wasn't this a wonderful New Year's Eve?
Yeah. The whole country got in the spirit of the thing.
That's right. I saw pictures in the newspaper. One picture of President Truman watching the clock in the White House, ready to blow a whistle. One picture of Governor Dewey watching the clock in the state capitol, ready to blow a horn. And one picture of Mayor LaGuardia watching the clock at City Hall, ready to blow.
Fiorello and the old year went out at the same time.
Yeah, but really it was sad seeing LaGuardia leave City Hall. First came the moving men with his desk. Then some clerks came out with his files. Then his secretary came out with his briefcase.
When did LaGuardia come out?
Who do you think was in the briefcase?
Well, I bet the mayor felt kind of blue leaving City Hall for the last time on New Year's Eve.
Yes, Kenny, but at least Fiorello had company. He wasn't the only half pint to disappear on New Year's Eve.
But Fiorello did a great, sincere job, didn't he, Eddie?
Oh, you said it. And already he's missed. Only one day and he's missed 2 days. Especially by the firemen. Today I passed by a fire station and saw 6 firemen at half-mast.
6 firemen at half-mast?
Yeah, in memory of LaGuardia, they only slid halfway down the pole.
Well, Eddie, I hope you had as much fun New Year's Eve as the gang did at your party.
Oh, I sure did. But, Kenny, after the party, you should have seen me over at Times Square all dressed up. I had on my tails, white tie, and one of those derbies that fold up.
Oh, no, wait a minute, Eddie. You're thinking of a high silk hat. A derby doesn't fold up.
It does in Times Square on New Year's Eve.
Well, this New Year's Eve, there was a record-breaking crowd in Times Square.
He's telling me. And such pushing. The pushing and the shoving and the shoving and the push. My suspenders broke at 42nd Street, and my pants didn't fall down till I got to 59. At 59, somebody started to pick them up for me. 72nd Street.
Well, Eddie, there's one thing I can't understand. Perhaps you can explain it.
Yep.
With millions of people celebrating New Year's Eve, throwing confetti, tearing up newspapers, discarding horns, New York streets are so clean. Why is that?
Well, I'll let you in on something, Kenny. Here in New York, we have a special place where we throw all our dirt and rubbish.
Oh, what do you call it?
The subway. Such a mess. And, Kenny, did you read about that flood they had in the subway the other day?
Yeah, Eddie, is it true that at one station the water rose 4 feet high in one of the trains?
Yeah, and that was the first time in the history of the subway the men got up and let the women sit down. And what a wild night. But I love to watch people on New Year's Eve. For instance, there's the girl who has a good time but doesn't drink. All she wants from life is the olive out of your martini. So all night long, she keeps dunking her mitt in your drink, grabbing the olives. Finally, when you pass out, she accuses you of not being able to hold your liquor. When it's drinking her nail polish that did it. By the time you get to a doctor, you swallowed so much nail polish, they have to use a buffer on your stomach. And then, Kenny,
yeah.
Then there's the fella. You must know him. The fella who seems to be fine all evening till you're ready to leave. Then he folds up. So you quick get his coat, his hat, his muffler. Run out and get a cab. Run back. Dress him. Help him into the cab. Take him home. Take his key out of his pocket. Hold him up with one hand. Open the door with the other. Push him in. And the minute he steps inside his house, he sobers right up, fixes himself something to eat, and goes to bed. He's fast asleep, and you're stuck somewhere in Brooklyn.
Eddie, I enjoyed the party you gave the gang this New Year's Eve. Do you always celebrate by throwing a party?
Oh, no, Kenny. Last New Year's, I went to Ciro's in Hollywood. What a time. By 12 o'clock, Jack Benny... Jack Benny was under the table. Under the table, Jack Benny.
Well, I didn't think Jack Benny was a drinking man. How long was he under the table?
Till someone paid the check.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the money place. You've heard about the new higher rates on savings accounts. Maybe you've seen ads that mention 7% or more interest on savings certificates. Well, a savings certificate is a special account. 2.5 years is the minimum term on the new 6.75% certificates. At the Big B, Burritt Mutual, they work like this. Deposit $1,000 in one of these certificates and leave it on deposit, and you'll earn even more than 6.75%. That's because Burritt pays you interest continuously, and the interest earns interest too. So the actual yield at maturity comes to 7.08% at the Big B. That's the straight story, the facts. That's what you'll get at any office of the Big B in New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Member FDIC.
It's great hearing these old recordings and talking about it, but time has a way of moving along, and we have run out of time.
Time marches on. Right. Westbrook Van Voorhis, God bless him.
But, Kenny, I want to thank you very much for being with us here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Well, it's a great pleasure. I've enjoyed every minute. And when can you make it a weekly feature?
Wish we could.
Let's hope very soon. But until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and the recordings of Ed Corcoran has been brought to you by WTIC and by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. Be sure to hear the next Golden Age of Radio broadcast October 24th, at the same time, when we present a triple-decker all-comedy program with Peter Donald, Will Jordan, and Jack Pearl as Baron Munchausen. With the engineering and technical assistance of Mike Russell and Bob Schirego, the Golden Age of Radio is produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. This is Norm Peters.
Pillsbury Snow Sheen Cake Flour brings you Grand Central Station.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host to welcome you in through the squeaking door to another half hour of horror. Come in, won't you? Sit down. I hope you'll forgive me.
I don't know. I can see what happened.
Somebody, I see. Somebody knows.
Yes, I know.
Claghorn's the name. Senator Claghorn, that
is. I know you're from the South.
When I'm in New York, I'll never go to the Yankee Stadium.
Now, wait a minute.
I'll even go to see the Giants unless the South Pole pitches. Well, look. I refuse.